note. So.
Okay, this is session number 9, July 18, 2006, the first cassette. And we're now back into the LaRouche world, the left-hand side of the book, Fatty Commune with Bob Dobbs, and we're going to be thinking totally differently from McLuhan, which we did last session. This is a guy who builds his thinking up on, in simple terms, not on the senses and what our senses show us, whereas McLuhan deals with life through the senses. And this quote is from S.I. That's the code at the end of the quote, S.I.L.L., page 46, and S.I. stands for the sexual impotence of the Puerto Rican Socialist Party. This was in a long essay LaRouche did in November 1973 in the journal, his own journal, The Campaigner, The Sexual Impotence of the Puerto Rican Socialist Party. So Scott's going to read the two paragraphs we have excerpted here on page 12 of our book.
Begins with the question, what is thought? What is thought? It's the judgment which is regulated by the increase or decrease of the sense of identity. One acts not merely to attain fixed objects, fixed sensuous acts, but to obtain those objects, actualize those thought acts which mediate an increased sense of identity. In the pathological state, the force of judgment is regulated by an internalized babble of images, dominated usually by the mother image. With small effort, one can bring up the mother image, either reinforcing or reducing the sense of identity as an immediate regulator of, quote-unquote, sincerity of feeling in the adult. It's the same in politics. In this sense, the neurotic adult must be systematically regarded as a pseudo-adult, either as the victim of individual neurosis or that of collective neurosis recognized as bourgeois ideology. His sense of identity is pathologically determined by childish fantasies and not by self-consciousness of his positive basis for adult experience.
Adult existence.
Existence. By contrast, the revolutionary is essentially the only true adult, by contrast with the pseudo-adult children about him. The neurotic loves his wife as a surrogate for his mother. The adult loves his mother and father, not as internalized images, but as actual human beings, and loves his wife as an actual human being in her own right. He has put aside his mother and father, who become specially loved peers on the outside of his identity, and locates his identity in the adult woman who has become the focus of his sense of identity. In this...
That's the end of the quote.
Yeah, okay.
So... have you read this before? These two pages?
Yeah. I was just reading it through a little while ago.
So what do you make of this?
Well, it seems sort of obvious and slightly dated to me. When was this written?
1973,
yeah. At the time that he wrote this, it may have been something that was sort of a new idea within the psychoanalytic community or something that hadn't been made too publicly aware. But I think anybody that studied psychology would sort of be aware of this. I don't think there's anything new here. What do you think?
Well, I think his answer to the question, what is thought, is pretty interesting. What is thought? And he says it's the judgment which is regulated by the increase or decrease of the sense of identity. Now, I don't think anybody has ever said thought was that. Based on the ratio of increase or decrease of the sense of identity determines your judgment.
Mm-hmm.
And so then he says one acts not merely to attain fixed...
What do you think he means by a sense of identity? Is he talking about conscious awareness on a scale, or like a light bulb becoming brighter or dimmer? Or is he talking about identity as in the sense of personality traits? What do you think he means by identity?
Well, he tries to say it in the next sentence. He defines it... Did you laugh there?
No, I was just agreeing.
Yeah. He says, one acts not merely to attain fixed objects, fixed sensuous acts. There's the emphasis, you know, his emphasis that you don't focus too much on your sensory reality. As a fixed reality that's never going to change. because he believes technology changes the sensuous facts, like McLuhan in a way. It changes the sensuous facts you live in. So one acts not merely to attain fixed objects, fixed sensuous acts, but to obtain those objects, actualize those thought acts. So he's saying he got fixed objects, he got sensuous acts, then he says objects again, then he says thought acts, which mediate an increased sense of identity. So what's the distinction between fixed objects, fixed sensuous acts, and to obtain those objects, actualize those thought acts? So it's interesting, he has thought as intimately immanent, pervading into the sensory world. Like, you know, an act and a thought are pretty close. Then he goes into silly thought and how it has a silly identity. He says, in the pathological state, the force of judgment is regulated. So remember, thought is the force of your judgment. And your judgment is not trying to get fixed states, it's trying to actualize your thought acts. In the pathological state, the force of judgment is regulated by an internalized babble of images dominated usually by the mother image. With small effort, one can bring up the mother image, either reinforcing or reducing the sense of identity as an immediate regulator of sincerity of feeling in the adult. It is the same in politics. So he's written about this before, about the mother image, like, you know, the Queen Elizabeth of England is a big mother image, and society is immature to the degree it bases its image, its identity, on the mother image. So one can bring up the mother image, either reinforcing or reducing the sense of identity as an immediate regulator of sincerity of feeling. So being sincere, and then there was a lot of New Age, remember John Lennon was in that therapy, primal therapy back then. There was a lot of talk about getting in touch with their feelings and things. I think back in the late 60s, early 70s, in American culture. And I think he's criticizing that as something that your thought act or identity should be based on. Because he says, as an immediate regulator of sincerity of feeling in the adult, it is the same in politics.
Mm-hmm.
In this sense, the neurotic adult must be systematically regarded as a pseudo-adult. In other words, he doesn't actually do real thought, either as the victim of individual neurosis or of that collective neurosis recognizes bourgeois ideology, which would have a big mother image hypnosis. His sense of identity is pathologically determined by childish fantasies and not by self-consciousness of his positive basis for adult existence. So there's a definition of thought as a healthy thought. Real thought is based on your historical role. Self-consciousness of your positive basis for continuing and enhancing the world of adults and in general around you. By contrast, the revolutionary is essentially the only true adult, by contrast with the pseudo-adult children about him. Now, this is LaRouche writing as Lynn Marcus. He doesn't become Lynn and LaRouche, really, till 75, 76. So he's still putting on the Marxist world around him in New York City and in the student revolutionaries, and he's calling himself a revolutionary, but he's a true adult. That's revolutionary. The neurotic loves his wife as a surrogate for his mother. The adult loves his mother and father not as internalized images, but as actual human beings, and loves his wife as an actual human being in her own right. Now, that would be old-fashioned, because right then feminism is coming up. And LaRouche wasn't a fan of the feminist ideology, but he certainly would consider himself a feminist in a more comprehensive sense of allowing women to develop their own selves and their own thinking and political role in developing new technologies, which would be new nature. So the idea of, you know, treating your wife as a human being, maybe from the feminist point of view, a revolutionary idea in the late 60s, early 70s. And from their point of view, if they read this, this wouldn't have any staying power, because they would say feminism by the 80s had achieved a lot of its goals, and women were demanding the rights to be a human being. So I think of that part as might be sounding old-fashioned. And he has put aside his mother and father. You know, if he loves his wife as an actual human being, he has put aside his mother and father, who become especially love peers on the outside of his identity and locates his identity in the adult woman who has become the focus of his sense of identity. Now, you know, we've had many changes in the family structure over the last 30 years, and there's not hardly any families left in the heterosexual sense in North America. I think it's about 50% of the population is single. In terms of changes in the sociology of life, McLuhan might have a better handle on that. But LaRouche would dealing with eternal principles that aren't subject to fads and the rise and falls of the moral quality of a society. He's saying the individual is sovereign, and that has to be recognized, and only true adults do that, and doing that is thought. I don't think people think of thought as part of your relationship to other people. Do you know what I mean? We think of thought as some abstract mental activity that it's good to develop, and it works in its own laboratory, whether the laboratory is an office or a business or a school or a trade union. But to link it to identity, I think, is interesting. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. And I think
you would never. What is? If you ask someone what is thought, they'd have all kinds of thoughts, statements about what thought is as an abstract function of the brain. It's information, blah blah blah. But this is a very unique statement. It is the judgment which is regulated by the increase or decrease of the sense of identity, and it means a healthy sense of identity, and a less healthy sense of identity than decrease of thought.
Yeah, and I think he couples thought and emotion and action. I think he thinks that in the healthy, he believes that in the healthy individual, there's emotional power behind the thought, but thought...
Now, holistic, he's holistic.
Yeah, holistic, yeah. Because emotions detached from thoughts are kind of impulsive, maybe primal or infantile, maybe irrational, but emotion provides... the emotive force or power behind actions or activities. So thought being reason or logos, if you put thought and emotion together, you no longer have uncoupled thinking. You no longer have disassociated thoughts and disassociated emotional impulses. You have something that's holistic and it leads to action.
Yes, but he makes action. It shouldn't just be unifying. He goes beyond unifying of thought and emotion and relates it to social action and into making new technologies and contributing to the growth of better sources of energy and better transmission of education and allowing more people to be healthy contributors
So he's bringing in a sense of purpose. It's this purpose that unifies thought, emotion, and action towards a higher purpose.
Yeah, it's like a thought act could be a purpose. Doesn't he even say that? He talks about purpose, I think, but... where was it? This whole thing of attaining fixed objects, actualizing thought acts, which mediate an increased sense of identity. Yeah, that's purpose. But it's not like people, they go to therapy groups, since the 70s, and they get centered. Then they go back into society. But they're like centering their chemical body. And they don't recognize that you need to center yourself in relation to the environment's technological bodies. And that is not talked about. They just talk about getting you relaxed from the pressures of life so that you can go back and do your job. LaRouche says, no, you don't leave and you don't go anywhere. You just get focused on contributing and not having biases about whether technologies are bad or you become a Luddite or... fascist and all these things. It's a practical, reasonable, almost bourgeois ideology from other cultures' point of view. But I like the way he integrates.
Mm-hmm.
So thought act, which is based on in a sense of identity and purpose and objects and goals.
Yeah. And in the previous section that we read, I remember him saying that if the thought act doesn't occur, in other words, if the act is frustrated, then the thinking and the emotions are frustrated. I think he says something along those lines.
And he talks about being self-conscious. The previous paragraph ends saying, accordingly, if one studied artistic and other personalities who are merely creative or only yet potentially self-conscious, one would tend to occur with Kuby's argument that the creative process must be regarded as a virtue in itself. But see, it's not, the creative process is not a virtue in itself, is his point.
Mm-hmm.
It's involved with society. You know what I mean? It's not
right.
Art for art's sake. It's basically telling everybody to be a scientist in the way we sort of romanticize science.
Yeah.
But if we implement, like he always tells, he used to talk about professors at universities were impotent because they didn't run for office. They didn't apply their knowledge. He believed in regular electioneering and that you're a real knowledge, healthy knowledge thought actor if you engage in politics. And not like go off and do research and then kind of just present a paper to something and you're just giving it to the public to consider. It's like, I create the information and you make the choice. That kind of thinking LaRouche tries to undermine. But to do what LaRouche recommends would create a lot of chaos for most institutions.
Mm-hmm.
But maybe he would say, yeah, let's... go through schooling, but he put down all the schools. He said the education is terrible. So it's most societies would consider this pretty idealistic, what he's setting out here, right?
Mm-hmm.
And impractical.
Yeah. He's also, he's a bit patriarchal here. I mean, he's talking about from the masculine point of view,
yeah.
Locates his identity in the adult woman. He's not talking about it from the reverse perspective of the female. He's talking about it from the perspective of the male.
Right, but that's the way society was up till the early 70s.
Mm-hmm.
And the North American society. Feminism doesn't really get changing people's lives till by the end of the 70s, I think. I know people who women who went into college, into law school, medical schools, professional schools in the early 70s, and that was new, the quantities of women doing that. But LaRouche believes he states that there needs to be enough technological development so that more families and their children have time to study and learn. And he thinks it's better to have a smaller number of kids, and the nuclear family is the healthiest form, and there must be enough time for the mother to nurture the children. So I think he agrees with the normal, what now would be called family value stuff. But remember, his slogan was, let's put a woman on Mars. He did not think that women had to stay just be family raisers. He wanted them involved in science. So he had a feminist point of view. It's just that writing it here, it appears that way, but that's the way it was back then. Men were running the show in the late 60s, early 70s.
Mm-hmm.
And the only reason you could say that women were brought into the employment world is there was so much new paperwork and entertainment services, media, electric radio, TV, movies. There was a lot more room as we got into a hyper-information society and entertainment society, more room for people to do gigs in those worlds.
Mm-hmm.
So that, though, would be employment for software stuff that LaRouche would object to because it was not dealing with hardware breakthroughs.
I wonder if we could say if the software world was displacing the mother in the home also.
Oh, that did happen. Now, that's what McLuhan's point was. It's interesting, McLuhan, he emphasizes the immediate media environments and their services and large disservices, and LaRouche ignores those issues and stays on course, right?
Mm-hmm.
But he got marginalized because staying on course with hardware notions, new hardware notions, just gets disappeared and marginalized in a software society. Anyway, so he stayed on course, and he's trying to define for a literate audience how to define where we are and what should be done and how to state what our values are and to counter all the other proliferating value systems via cults and new therapies and all that was going on in the information society.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So,
staying on course, implies linear progression, and that's left hemisphere, and
Right, from McLuhan's point of view. But LaRouche does not think it's left hemisphere. He thinks it's real progressive evolution.
Mm-hmm.
So he would put down those categories. He would critique these things of these little dialectics between left hemisphere and right hemisphere. Mm-hmm. I mean, he criticizes modern physics for being pairwise, P-A-I-R, pairwise notions of matter, electrons, protons, and the subatomic particles, which you see Stephen Hawking, these guys working on. He critiques that whole pairwise view of reality. And left hemisphere and right hemisphere would be just another example of popular pairwising, which is irrelevant to exploring through thought acts, which will later get into him defining how you do this, the hypothesis of the higher hypothesis, and then the hypothesis of the hypothesis of the higher hypothesis, and developing new technologies.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's, you can really see that having that view and writing and propagandizing about that constantly, day in, day out. And then think of all the other propagators that are going on and expanding information society of fragmented information society of the 70s, 80s. No wonder he got lost. He was just another guy mouthing off. But it's interesting why I preserved his writings is that in terms of defining things, he's unique in how he defines it. Nobody writes about thought acts and technology and a holistic view of emotion and sensory engagement for the purpose of the higher hypothesis like he does.
Mm-hmm.
So I think let's go on to the next paragraph.
Okay.
The next quote, because he's going to go into more of this infantile ego kind of stuff, you know, that is just not healthy.
Mm-hmm.
And he thinks the immature society encourages.
Mm-hmm.
All right?
Okay. In the case of the individual...
No. Let's state... Now, this is from the same essay, and it is page 63 and 64. So this is 20 pages later in The Campaigner. Now, remember, the title is The Sexual Impotence of the Puerto Rican Socialist Party. Now, the Puerto Rican Socialist Party were a fringe party, I think, in New York City. And maybe they had representatives in Puerto Rico, but they were quite active. You remember... No, I won't go into that. Anyways, they were quite active in the New York scene and were becoming controversial as activists, radicals in New York City. I think I'd have to go back and look at the article, but that's what I remember this one was referring to. And LaRouche is still on the socialist side of things in this period in 73, so he's criticizing his competition. You know what I mean?
Okay.
And he would probably call it, you know, tribalism.
But,
he may not use that word, but... It would be a tribal immaturity that he would be confronting. So this quote is in that essay.
Mm-hmm.
Were you going to say something else?
Well, the Puerto Rican Socialist Party, it sounds like a rather puny opposition.
That's right. It's a very puny operation. That's what I mean. You know, the left is already weak in the early 70s and marginalized, and then within the left are these little factional fights, and LaRouche is in one against another obscure little group.
Mm. And his concepts... aren't limited to... I mean, what he's talking about here is pretty global. It's
yes.
Not limited to the Puerto Rican Socialist Party.
Yeah, and also, when he's writing this for the whole world, and for most of the world, there was that family patriarchal situation going on. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So we don't want to look at it as the particular context of the United States and how feminism was rising there and created all these problems. For the patriarchal structure. This is for the whole world, and they're still living in the 19th century in a lot of ways, right? If you ignore the discarnate effect that McLuhan refers to.
Right.
So this is addressed to the average working person who probably doesn't have much of an education in the third world and the second world everywhere, right?
Mm-hmm.
So here we go.
Yeah. And so these are the next two paragraphs, the bottom of page 12 going into page 14. Okay.
Yes, because McLuhan's on page 13, and we're staying on the left side. So 12 into page 12 of my book, going overlapping into page 14.
Mm-hmm. In the case of the individual clinging to the bourgeois infantile ego, either through the mediation of the mother image or the love object of a banalized sexual relationship, the experiencing of even a significant outpouring of the fundamental emotion is an experience of psychological near death. Wow. The fundamental emotion. Okay. The quote-unquote threat of the emotion is associated with the shrinking of the ego down to a quote-unquote point, surrounded by a, you got to help me with this word.
Schwärmerei, German word, quote-unquote, of fragmented thoughts and feelings.
Okay. In such instances where they occur in a clinical setting, the problem is resolved by bringing the self-conscious identity to quote-unquote wakefulness at the same time that the individual is disassociated from whatever infantile preoccupations are causing strong attachments to the infantile ego.
Next paragraph.
One should add, for emphasis, that there is a direct connection between this sort of phenomena and the remedying of even severe psychosomatic illness. Intestinal psychosomatic involvements and migraine headache syndromes are among the most accessible to remedy in this way. And then in parentheses, indeed, the variety of disturbances falsely deemed of organic
etiology, which means organic causes, causation factors.
Which are
indeed the variety of disturbances falsely deemed of organic etiology,
which are susceptible of remedy or significant improvement through analysis, indicates that psychosomatic medicine is of far greater importance and engages much more of the realm of quote-unquote organic disorders than is usually admitted even by professionals. Even if the organic problems can
no,
be... If the quote-unquote organic problem can be remedied or checked by psychoanalytic clinical methods, then the case for its probably psychosomatic origins has been strongly made. End of the parenthesis. The link between psychological disorders and somatic disorders shown to be connected to this psychopathology is through the mediation of the fundamental emotion, which is obviously linked to proprioceptive and ACTH.
The acronym for adrenocorticotrophic hormone dynamics.
Dynamics.
So this is interesting. So he's talking about the chemistry of a fundamental emotion and how it's in the interval between the psycho parts and then the somatic parts, right?
Mm-hmm.
So he's talking about the interval between the mind and body.
Interesting, yeah.
Interesting thick thing here. So let's go through.
Probably relates to his discussion on love, which was on previous pages that we were...
Yeah, he's saying that the neurotic individual can't handle the fundamental emotion of being connected with people.
Mm.
So let's see if that fits. I'm going to reread it. In the case of the individual clinging to the bourgeois infantile ego, which we were discussing in the previous quote, what is thought about identifying with this mother and dependent kind of person. In the case of the individual clinging to the bourgeois infantile ego, either through the mediation of the mother image or the love object of a banalized sexual relationship, the experiencing of even a significant outpouring of the fundamental emotion is an experience of psychological near death. So he's saying this is just too much for them. Now we jump ahead to the last sentence. The link between psychological disorders and somatic disorders shown to be connected to the psychopathology is through the mediation of the fundamental emotion, which is obviously linked to proprioceptive and adrenocorticotrophic hormone dynamics. So he's again is another holistic view. He has no problem with mind-body perceptions as key to health. And that became a big factor in New Age alternative medicine in the 80s and 90s. And he's right that professional people in medicine in the 60s and early 70s, when this is being written, did not take the mind-body connection seriously, right?
Mm-hmm.
They being, there's different schools of thought explaining why medicine would not see a connection between the mind and the body.
Although medicine did recognize the placebo effect.
The what effect?
Placebo effect.
Placebo. Oh, placebo, right.
Double blind studies were often done using placebos.
Right, but I don't know when that started. Maybe that started in the 40s and 50s. It definitely became popular notion by the 80s and 90s. Now, this is coming out of psychiatry, which, you know, by the 60s, 70s, had a bit of establishment sanction. But there were new revolutions happening in the psychoanalytical world coming out of the human potential movement, represented by Esalen and, you know, out of Big Sur and all kinds of alternative therapies, which were going a little further. So LaRouche is talking psychosomatic. It's interesting. I guess psychiatry talked about psychosomaticism, but the popular culture didn't think of it too much. But they do now, though. Okay, so going back to this, he's saying this fundamental emotion, which may be explained earlier, but I didn't include it, so we're just taking the phrase fundamental emotion to mean whatever we think it means. But let's say it means some kind of real emotion. And he's saying the immature person can't handle it. The threat of the emotion is threat of the fundamental emotion is associated with the shrinking of the ego down to a point surrounded by a short mirage of fragmented thoughts and feelings. So this, the ego becomes a sense of, that's a point, a paranoid point, with all kinds of random conscious dreamlike suggestibilities. In such instances where they occur in a clinical setting, the problem is resolved by bringing the self-conscious identity to wakefulness at the same time that the individual is dissociated from whatever infantile preoccupations are causing strong attachments to the infantile ego. One should add, for emphasis, that there is a direct connection between this sort of phenomenon and the remedying of even severe psychosomatic illnesses. So he was talking about the emotion affecting a person's ego identity. Now he's... And the second paragraph is showing how it affects the chemical body. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And the remedying of severe psychosomatic illnesses must include this recognition of the fundamental emotion threatening the infantile ego and having the ego have stomach aches and headaches. Intestinal psychosomatic involvements and migraine headache syndromes are among the most accessible to remedy in this way. Remedying by recognizing, I guess, the fundamental emotion has this effect on you. Indeed, the variety of disturbances falsely deemed of organic etiology, in other words, chemical causes, which are susceptible of remedy or significant improvement through analysis, indicates that psychosomatic medicine is of far greater importance, engages much more the realm of organic disorders than is usually admitted even by professionals. So this is definitely against drug companies. This view is against drug companies. And by the 90s, LaRouche was doing articles on the terrible domination of drug, you know, Prozac and that kind of stuff in modern medicine.
Mm-hmm.
So he's taking a humanist view, a non-drug view here of curing remedies. And if you just think they're curing ailments, if you thought they were just based on organic chemical causes, that would lead to mistakes. And he's saying the fact that you can heal yourself through psychosomatic recognitions and wakefulness shows that it's not just organic causation factors here,
yeah,
right?
It sounds like he's saying that this fundamental emotion is a curative force in and of itself.
Yeah, and that fundamental emotion would be a sense of healthy, purposeful identity.
Yeah.
A full understanding of the LaRouche program, agreeing with LaRouche. If the organic problem can be remedied or checked by psychoanalytical clinical methods, then the case for its probably psychosomatic origins has been strongly made. The link between psychological disorders and somatic disorders shown to be connected to this psychopathology is through the mediation of the fundamental emotion, the dealing with the fundamental emotion, which is obviously linked to a proprioceptive and, this big word, adrenocorticotrophic hormone dynamics. So he's saying the fundamental emotion is... It's interesting, he says proprioceptive. That's one of the reasons I put in there. I like that. Link to proprioceptive dynamics. He's bringing in a bit of chemistry that mediates and is involved with the fundamental emotion, but that includes the mind, and we come back to our holistic model of thought, sense, emotion, and purpose, and technological engagement, cultural engagement, right?
Mm-hmm.
So he's being holistic here.
Yeah.
So the point is that if you think LaRouche is some fascist guy, who's knocking the New Agers who are holistic, and he's not holistic, you're wrong. He is competent here in conventional terms of what people thought was healthy views by the 80s, right?
Right.
Okay, let's move on to the next paragraph. Okay, so the next quote is, it's a long one, and it's from an essay called Rockefeller's Fascism with a Democratic Face. This is another long essay by LaRouche, put out in his magazine, The Campaigner, November, December 1974. So this is right when, this is after Watergate. President Ford, Nixon's out in August 74, and his vice president, Gerald Ford, who replaced Spiro Agnew, is now president, and he is lobbying for Nelson Rockefeller to be the vice president. And I think around the fall, November period, December 1974 is when Rockefeller had to appear before, you know, congressional hearings to state his case about how he's qualified to be a vice president. So this is what LaRouche is countering, you know, Rockefeller's move to take over the White House. So the article's called Rockefeller's Fascism with a Democratic Face, and this is pages 31 and 32 of that essay. So you want to begin, Scott?
There's no intrinsic, quote-unquote, competition between man and the biosphere of which he is a hegemonic part. Quite the contrary, the phenomena of, quote-unquote, ecological crises, which we witness today, are accounted for primarily by the dysfunctional primitive accumulation characteristic of capitalistic development, and are not intrinsic to the industrial expansion and technological development otherwise characteristic of this social reproductive process. The development of society has brought us to the point during the past 10,000 years that human social reproductive processes have taken over the biosphere to the extent that the very existence of that biosphere depends essentially on its willful maintenance and development as part of the social reproductive process.
Willful is italicized. Willful maintenance and development as part of social reproductive processes. Yep.
The notion that ecology would prosper if man were to abandon it to freely resume some hypothetical, quote-unquote, wild nature state is a
wild natural state.
Is a simpleton's absurdity. Pull the man out of the ecology and a disastrous ecological collapse would quickly ensue.
Let me just say at this point, it's interesting. He's calling the notion that the ecology would prosper if we removed ourselves from it. He's talking the bio, what's he called, social reproductive, what's the phrase? Man and the biosphere is an integrated, holistic, including the man's inventions. That is the ecology. Whereas some people think that, you know, jumping into nature was like getting back into the ecology. So note how he's using the word ecology. It's including technology, right?
Mm-hmm.
Pull man out of the ecology, and a disastrous ecological collapse would quickly ensue.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, next paragraph.
Man has transformed the biosphere from a pre-human lower level of negentropic values to higher forms. In this process, the Earth has been transformed from a lower level of existence as a wild state into a higher level of at a level as man's garden. The higher state of ecological processes represented by that garden could not have developed without man, and cannot maintain themselves without appropriate human activity. Remove the gardener or reduce his gardening activities to a level below that required, and the garden will deteriorate. To remove man or reduce his role is to deprive the biosphere of the key species on which the balance of ecology depends. The problem is not maintaining the garden in some fixed present state. The present ecology as a whole is subject to the same essential principles as the first phases of the development of the biosphere. The free energy characteristics of living forms demand...
No, singular. The free energy characteristic.
The free energy characteristic of living forms demands that the process of further development must continue, or the ecology must turn into an auto-cannibalistic phase. Since the only means by which the ecology generally is able to effect the necessary progress is its human agency, a reduction in the negentropic activities of mankind, such as putting society into a quote-unquote zero state of negative auto-cannibalistic reproduction, must result in a corresponding onset of auto-cannibalistic processes in the biosphere generally. The general way in which ecological auto-cannibalism occurs is well known. It is broadly analogistic to the heuristic outline we gave for economic auto-cannibalism.
Yeah, that was the concentration camps in World War II, where they just used up human slavery in a very non-negentropic, entropic process, and they just were running out of things. Auto-cannibalistic, right?
Mm-hmm. The weakening of the conditions for the maintenance of the higher forms of life in the ecology shifts the ecological values to emphasize the proliferation of relatively primitive forms which mediate the obliteration of the thermodynamically doomed higher species. The action of insects, fungi, bacteria, and viruses as lower forms performing this mediating entropic function of auto-cannibalism are generally known. The elaboration of that here would be more entertaining than essential. The essential point is that for thermodynamic auto-cannibalism, the process of decay is not a matter of the appearance of just one mode of auto-cannibalism. The action of the initial mode is to reduce the thermodynamic value of the ecology as a whole, lowering the quote-unquote temperature and shifting the mode to a lower, less efficient form of auto-destruction than to...
And then to another.
Like the economic model for fascist economy, the process of ecological auto-cannibalism is a chain reaction.
So what do you get from that? What's the main point you get from this?
Well, first it's interesting to me that he feels that if man was pulled out of the equation, that ecology, the nature would collapse.
Yes.
I'm not quite sure I understand all the implications of that. Nature evolved quite nicely without human intervention for a very, very, very long time.
Well, did it? It was a state of chaos. It evolved, didn't evolve. It arrived at a certain stable state, but then humans, he's saying, came in and have improved the ecology.
Well, we've improved the ecology to suit our own comfort.
Yes,
survival.
And he said that we're looking here at someone who is looking at second nature. What humans make is like nature. It is nature. It adds to nature. So he's similar to McLuhan, or at least the basis McLuhan, the assumption McLuhan has, is that technologies are the real world of evolution. That what first nature created was finished, and then humans come in and start adding on second nature. So his definition of ecology is the man and biosphere interaction.
Yeah.
So the normal ecologists reading this, they think of nature as ecology and human as some virus is screwing it up.
Yeah.
But LaRouche is saying that humans are necessary. They need to keep improving the technology. If not, it falls back and it gets eventually back to the state of original nature, and that is a very auto-cannibalistic situation. Some people would say, no, nature seems, it stays balanced on its own. So this is the crux of LaRouche's distinction difference from other assumptions in the ecological world. This paragraph lays it out. You know what I mean? This is his position.
Well, nature does have
agree with it.
Yeah, nature does have a way of balancing itself on its own. Otherwise, nature...
Well, how would we know?
Because it was here before we got here, and it was already balancing and rebalancing itself.
Well, how do you know it was balancing? We weren't here.
We couldn't have arrived on the scene if we didn't have a stable environment, and we look around at the billion-plus species of creatures all cohabitating this planet.
No, but we arrived as another product of its interactions and its chemistry. If that is why we don't know how we arrived, but assuming the general science view that we arrived as an accident of nature, we were a new product, and we were in a very difficult environment. And other species had been coming and going, too. So the thing is that we could argue this is the kind of thing that probably can't be definitely concluded. So we're just establishing here the LaRouche view, which is worth considering. And I like it as an anti-environment to the assumptions that people had in the 70s and 80s about ecology. He is saying, now he's not saying just, you know, making better mousetraps or electric toothbrushes is helping the ecology. The ecology, which is society's ability to maintain itself and to expand and learn more, since it has to make its technologies better so that it can have a better holistic ecology, that effort has to be promoted properly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he says that nature had negentropic values, which were raised to a higher level of negentropic value with the introduction of human technology.
Yeah.
And that the value of, I believe, his sense of purpose here is that we need to continue to develop higher negentropic values, like, as you would say, through the introduction of cold fusion.
Yeah.
Because the state of negentropic values in the balance of technology and nature right now are overloaded. I mean,
we're inadequate.
Yeah, we're collapsing, and we're not going to survive if we don't reach the next plateau.
Right. And